The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
In every war in American history, there have been suspensions of the Constitution. Emergencies lead to emergency powers, whether justified or not, but it always happens. Normally, though, at the end of the war, there is a return to the constitutional order. Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, and afterward the Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional. It might have been understandable why it happened in the emergency, but the emergency's over and we should end that emergency power. The same thing happened in World War II with the detention of Japanese Americans. The Supreme Court again said that was unconstitutional. But something happened in World War II that was even more unconstitutional and was never rectified because we were proud of it. The Manhattan Project was almost miraculously effective. People had thought, including very qualified people, that the atom bomb could not be built, and certainly not be built in that short time, less than 3 years. Built and deployed and kept secret in extraordinary ways. Now, it was illegal throughout. It was based on deception of Congress, on the use of unauthorized monies channeled through fake conduits, on spying on Americans and others, on a general acting outside the chain of military command, on the president setting up a secret directorship of the project, which had no oversight and no authorization. And yet, because it worked, we were not only happy to see that it worked, but we started imitating its procedures. The director of the project, Leslie Groves, demanded and got dictatorial powers. He bullied the people under him. He ran a police state at Los Alamos in which all thought and speech was monitored and censured and silenced. Everybody involved was not allowed to communicate with the outside world except through very limited monitored correspondence and telephone calls. He had his own little private air force. He not only had to make the bomb, but to deliver it. And so he took airplanes, which were in great demand, of course, these bombers for the war, right off the assembly line and spirited them away to secret locations where they were reconfigured to drop the bomb. And he had flight practices run by pilots who didn't know what they were doing it for. And they went out to Tinian Island and flew from there. He had practice runs actually going to Japan and dropping dummy bombs the same size and weight as the atomic bombs. They didn't know what they were doing. And all of this was outside the normal legal procedures of the United States, whether congressional or military or presidential. But we were so pleased that we got it, we ended the war with it, that we never looked at the illegal aspect of it. You know, when we look back at it, we wonder, did they have any qualms about dropping the bomb? In general, they didn't. They made it to end the war, and they thought it would end the war, And even the people who became later critics of aspects of nuclear weaponry, and especially of the hydrogen bomb, like Oppenheimer, said, no, we've got to use the bomb. And he wanted to drop both of the bombs on the same day to make an overwhelming demonstration of its power. And some people said, not very forcefully, well, why don't we do a demonstration of one bomb out on some uninhabited part of the ocean and say, look at this and see what will happen to you if you don't give in to us. And Oppenheimer said, what if it's not as powerful as we think? Remember, they had only tested it once in a tower, the Trinity at Alamogordo, under ideal conditions with no weather, no eddy aircraft against you, no problems with bomb sites and drop mechanisms and all of that. He said, what if it doesn't work or isn't as powerful as we say? It won't have its effect. And the same argument was used. Some people said, well, warn them. Warn Hiroshima that we're going to drop something on you, so get the hell out of there. And again, they said, well, what if it doesn't live up to its billing? And when Oppenheimer said, let's drop it on two places on the same day, Leslie Groves, in charge of the whole operation, said, no, we have to drop one first to see how it works and to make any correction that we might have to make for the second drop. The second drop was supposed to be more powerful and to suggest an infinite escalation. You know, we'll hit you with this, and then we'll hit you with more than this, and then we'll hit you, unhit you, and hit you if you don't give in. Actually, the second one was less effective because it was dropped off center because of cloud cover and hills and things. But the idea that you would not drop the bomb didn't even occur to most of the people, including President Truman. What they were thinking is, we have drawn off all this talent, all these great brains, all these billions of dollars in terms of modern money, and created this bomb, and then we didn't use it. And if there was an invasion of Japan and Americans died, you can imagine the reaction from their relatives, their relics, their heirs. Saying, we paid for it, we sacrificed for it, and you wouldn't use it to save us, probably the president would have been impeached. And Groves, Leslie Groves, the general, would have been court-martialed that they did all of this and didn't use the bomb. So the bomb had to be used, both of them. And there was never any question of waiting to see for the effect of the first on Japan before dropping the second. When Truman authorized the dropping of the bomb, it was both for dropping both. Now, when the war ended, as I say, other kinds of illegalities are corrected at the end of a war. This one was not, because we did not give up an emergency power when the emergency ended because we thought the emergency continued. We went directly from World War II into the Cold War, and we would go from there into the War on Terror. And so there was a sense of emergency. It was said, this bomb now is so powerful, what if somebody else gets it and tries to use it on us? And so the powers that were given to Leslie Groves were now given to the president. For the first time in American history, the president in the Atomic Energy Act was authorized on his own private decision with no oversight from Congress or anybody else, the cabinet, any part of the government, to initiate atomic war, nuclear war. The argument was this: if there's a sneak attack threatened or carried out on us with this new weapon, there'll be no time to talk to Congress, to test public opinion. The president will have to respond instantly, either anticipating or retaliating such an attack. Now, once that extraordinary power was given him, something outside the Constitution entirely, You know, only Congress has the power to declare war according to the Constitution. Here, he was given the power to initiate nuclear war, the worst kind of war, on his own, with no congressional approval or oversight or declaration. Not only that, he had to protect this great big secret that we had. He had to make sure nobody else could get at the secret so far as that could be prevented. And he had to spy on Americans who might let the secret out, and he had to spy on foreigners who might be prying into the secret. And he had to get the means of deploying the bomb. You know, as Groves had had his secret air force to deploy the bomb, he was given the Strategic Air Command to have planes up in the air every day of the week, 24 hours a day, flying the bomb around the world in case he decided we had to use it. Later on, of course, we would have submarines carrying nuclear weapons. Later on, we would have missiles carrying nuclear weapons. Later on, we would have satellite guidance of the missiles. And that deployment meant the establishment of a great international network of places to supply and refuel and monitor the radiation from other countries, to have radar installations. So that now we have 800 of these military bases, some of them secret, that were all born out of this attempt to have the capacity for deployment of the bomb anywhere around the world the minute the president decides on it. And the president then had to have other instruments, the NSA, the NSC, the CIA, to monitor and carry out secret operations and to preserve secrets. We had to have classification of all these secrets and clearance procedures to get at the classified information and loyalty tests to make sure that the people who knew the secrets would not let the secrets out. This set up this immense network of national security people who were originally set there for nuclear reasons, but quickly went beyond that. And the proof of that is the Korean War. That was not a nuclear war, although there was some consideration of using nukes later on. But at the beginning of it, Secretary of State Dean Acheson said to President Truman, "You don't have your nuclear power to respond on your own initiative without Congress's say-so for this war. But you have to do it anyway. Don't ask Congress for any kind of permission, because we've got to preserve your instantaneous response capacity in general, as a matter of principle, not only in nuclear wars." So the president refused to ask for any kind of congressional approval of the Korean War. And that began the era of undeclared wars, presidential wars. There's not been a congressional declaration of war ever since. And most of the wars have been initiated by the presidents without not only congressional approval, often without the public even knowing. Things like the Cuban Bay of Pigs invasion or the Iranian toppling of the Mossadegh administration. These kinds of wars go on secretly from everybody in America anyway. They're not secrets from the enemy, by the way. That's the interesting thing. The original justification of military secrecy is don't let your enemies know what you're going to do. If you're going to invade Europe, don't tell them when and where D-Day will occur. That makes sense. But, of course, after D-Day, there's no reason to keep the secret. But now we keep all of our secrets. And we keep them not from the enemy, but from Congress and the United States public. One of my favorite Gary Trudeau strips, Doonesbury strips, I have the original hanging on my wall, is a person going into Cambodia and looking at the ruined landscape and this fallen down building and a couple standing in front of it, and the person visiting says, "Wow, this is an historic site. This is the site of the secret bombing of Cambodia." And the man says, "Oh no, it was no secret. I said to Martha, 'Martha, look, see there are the bombs falling on us.' It was kept secret because Nixon didn't want Congress to know that he was doing an undeclared war on a country that we were not supposed to be at war with, and using funds that had been granted for other purposes." That's the normal situation now. Secrecy is used not to confuse an enemy, but to cover up the power of the president and the executive and the government in general to carry out the kinds of wartime initiatives that began with the Korean War. Secretary of State, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan has a number of things that he has reflected on in his great book, Secrecy. He says, for instance, that Fidel Castro knew about the Bay of Pigs because we were using all kinds of cat's paws in Miami and elsewhere, Cubans, who leaked like sieves, and everybody knew about it except Americans. And the New York Times heard about it and went to President Kennedy and said, "We know that this is going to occur. I think we should publish it because it doesn't make much sense." And the president said, if you do that, that will be unpatriotic and you will be vilified for betraying your country. So they didn't publish it. But Moynihan says, the Times caught on for the same reason that Fidel Castro did, and not only that, all experts on Cuba knew, academic experts, pollsters who had done things, journalists who had been down there, that the idea of provoking a rebellion against Fidel Castro at that point in his career, right after his successful rebellion, was absurd. It couldn't happen by putting on in this little band of Cuban soldiers of fortune. And Moynihan says, well, why didn't Kennedy know that? He said, because the people who all said that were unclassified. And the ones who went to him, the CIA and the military, said, we're the only ones who have access to the secrets, and so we're the only ones who know. These other people just don't know. You can't know unless you have access to the secrets. Access to the secrets is an exceedingly deceptive thing. We should have known that from the Vietnam War when Lyndon Johnson said, if you knew what I know about Vietnam, you would know how prudent and wise I am in my policies. But you can't know because you don't have clearance. And Daniel Ellsberg, who helped grow up the Pentagon Papers, released the Pentagon Papers to say, they didn't know anything. The big secret of the Pentagon Papers is that there were no secrets. It was all confused, muddled misinformation. When the first President Bush was going into the Kuwait War, he did ask for the assent of Congress, not for a declaration of war, and he didn't observe the War Powers Act, but with a time limit. But he did say, we think it's prudent to go in here, so why don't you agree with us? And Admiral Crow, who had been the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, went before Congress's Foreign Intelligence Committee and said, I think that sanctions have a chance to work still. We should use them a little bit longer before we invade. And the next day or so after, Secretary of State Jim Baker went to the same committee and said, well, Admiral Crow no longer has clearance. He can't read the cables, so his opinion is worthless. Which means, of course, that your opinion is worthless, and my opinion is worthless. And everybody's opinion is worthless who's not in the priesthood of the secrets. We have to just turn over to them the authority to decide for our good what only they can know. Once that starts, once you have the preservation of this expertise that nobody else can get at, it goes on a rampage, it gallops. So we have the classification of endless, endless things, and we have the cachet of clearance to read the endless, endless things, even though most of those who have the clearance don't read it anyway. That's what amazed Ellsberg. He had top clearance to go into the Pentagon and into their little highest plans room where you're constantly watched in the cage and you can't take anything down, etc., to look at the plans for nuclear retaliation in case of all-out attack, and said, they don't even cohere. You know, they've been drawn up by various people who didn't put them together into a normal scheme of things. So he went in a hawk and came out a dove. But the use of this secrecy, there are many, many examples. Let me give you one. Reynolds versus United States. There was an Air Force plane that went down, and there were some electronic experiments going on, and civilian people were conducting them. And when the plane had an accident, some survived, some perished. And the heirs of the civilians who perished saw interviews in the newspapers with those who survived who said, boy, there were things going wrong on that airplane from the very outset. And so they sued the Air Force for negligence that led to the death of their relatives. This went to two courts, both of which found for the people suing. And the Air Force said, well, we did an investigation, but we can't release the results of that, any of the results, because there were state secrets involved. Those electronic experiments were things vital to our national security. And the judges in both cases said, well, if that's the case, show the investigation to the judge in camera. And if he decides that the state secrets are such that the whole thing has to be rejected, then he will do it. Or if certain things can be separated out and preserve the state secrets, he'll do that. The Air Force refused to release anything. It went to the Supreme Court. And this was during the Korean War, the Vinson Court. And the court said, we can't destroy the morale of the Air Force at a time when it's at war. So we won't even look at the investigation in camera. Now that decision has been used as a justification for state secret rejection of cases several times a decade ever since. But that investigation was routinely declassified about 15 years later, and the relatives found out there were no state secrets involved at all, but there was overwhelming evidence of criminal neglect. The plane had had fires before, it had had bad upkeep, the pilot switched off the wrong engine at the time, the people on board were not told the procedures for bailing out or where to bail out. It was a clear-cut case of criminal negligence. It again went to the Supreme Court under a different plea, and the Supreme Court, and this is now the Rehnquist Court, consulted various people, including Ted Olson, who's kind of Kilroy showing up in all these cases, and he said, well, there was nothing directly about national security, but people might have got hints from the report which would lead them to other things that might be hints about other things. This was called the mosaic theory. If you have one little pebble, you can reconstruct the whole mosaic from that one little pebble. And so the court upheld the rejection of the plea of the relatives. And that state secret doctrine is still there and is still being used as a precedent. Whenever the government wants to say that there are state secrets, even though the case on which the whole argument is based was a lie, it continues to be a binding precedent. So once you set up this immense secret apparatus, it more and more resembles the thing it's modeled on, the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project was a little police state. Everybody there was spied on, monitored, censored, and they went along with it because it was a time of war and they thought they needed to do it to defeat the fascists. Many of the people there were immigrants from Europe and felt that the Nazis had to be defeated by all means and worked their hearts out for it. But secrecy and control and executive privilege emanated out from the Manhattan Project in a kind of radioactivity of its own and continues to do that to this day, even under President Obama, I'm sad to say, but we'll probably talk about that in the question period, so thank you for what I've said so far. Now, are there microphones circulating to hear the questions? Yes, there's. Any hands or any questions? They say there's one out there.
I just wanted to thank you first, Mr. Willis. I've read your Lincoln at Gettysburg and many of your articles in the New York Review, and I've learned a great deal from you. I wanted to thank you for that first. But though the policies of the U.S. government have been very destructive often, I also think there's such rampant incompetence on their part. They never do anything very well or very right, from Iran under Mossadegh to the Vietnam War to Iraq, so that though it's very destructive and ends up in many, many deaths that shouldn't have happened, I also think there's limited danger because they are so incompetent. I wonder if you would comment on that, sir.
Well, yes, their governments are incompetent often because they're unaccountable. But they've been made more incompetent and unaccountable because of the cult of secrecy and the presidential initiative that came out of World War II. As I say, we didn't have a relapse to the constitutional order. We had a continuation of the emergency time from World War II to the Cold War to the War on Terror. And President Truman was told by his advisors that you've got to have a tremendous sense of emergency. When he wanted to send money to Greece to construct a government that would repel the communists, Senator Vandenberg, the Republican from Michigan, was brought aboard to be the spokesperson for bipartisanship. And he said, if you're going to get the American people this soon after the war to start launching themselves back into Europe, you've got to scare hell out of the country. And, of course, that's what he did. The Truman Doctrine was very alarmist. Somebody who read it said, I went up and looked to see whether my World War II uniform still fit. Truman loved emergencies. He said, we've got to have universal military training so that there will be an army to respond immediately to war. Congress didn't let him have that. Then he tried to draft the railway workers when they were striking, saying, we've got to be ready for war and we've got to have railroads that run. So for my war powers, I'm going to do this. And that didn't work either. And then he seized the steel mills during the Korean War. And the Supreme Court knocked that down after he had done it. But in general, he set up the NSC, the NSA, the CIA, the Marshall Plan, the number of things that were emergency measures. And he became, the president from then on became a war president. Look at what happened to the term commander-in-chief. Commander-in-chief was a pretty mild thing up until World War II. Historically, it came from the British, and it meant when you have several admirals in the same part of the ocean working together, one, there can be competing authorities, so we will designate one as the commander-in-chief of the others. It was a temporary and geographically limited term. When the guy who was the commander-in-chief, that was not his office the way admiral was, and when he went out of that theater, he ceased to be the commander-in-chief. When George Washington went to Boston at the beginning of the Revolution, there were militia generals and other people who were had different state authorities, and the Congress said, you'll be the commander-in-chief. When they set up the Constitution, they said, the president will be the commander-in-chief of the military. And they meant the military at war, because they didn't think there was going to be a standing army in peacetime, of the military and of the state militias when summoned into national service, which they thought Congress would do. So he's not even the commander-in-chief of the National Guard, as we call them today, unless they've been nationalized. He's certainly not the commander-in-chief of civilians. And he's not even a military person. That was proved in a court case in New York when some of his heirs said, well, there's property here that's the estate of George Washington, so it should have the property taxes that we've given to veterans of the military. And that went to court, and the court said, well, you know, he was the head of the parts of the army before the Constitution came into effect at all. And he had certain pay and certain pensions then, and that's all over with. But as president, he's not a military officer. He doesn't get military pay. He doesn't get a military pension. He can't be court-martialed. The president is not a military office. It's a civilian office. We have civilian control of the military. That's the genius of the Constitution, that it made the commander-in-chief a civilian. Well, we've forgotten that. Now the commander-in-chief is supposed to be the commander-in-chief of everybody, and he's even saluted by the Marines when he comes off an airplane. That's a very new thing. It didn't happen to Eisenhower, who was a real general. It happened with Ronald Reagan, who was a movie general. And, you know, a salute is for the uniform. A general out of uniform is not saluted. And the president is not in uniform so far, and yet he's saluted as if he were a military figure. When the Saturday Night Massacre occurred during the Watergate investigations, Archibald Cox, who'd been set up as an independent counsel by the Congress, Nixon wanted to get rid of him. And so he had General Haig of his staff call the Justice Department and say, fire Cox. And the Attorney General said, no, I can't do that. He said, well, we'll fire you. And then he went to the Undersecretary, Ruckelshaus, and said, fire Cox. And he said, that's not what Congress had in mind when they set up the independent council. And he said, your commander-in-chief has given you an order. You have to obey. Ruckelshaus was a civilian. The president's not his commander-in-chief and has no power as commander-in-chief over him. After that, I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and I said, whatever else, constitutionally, the President of the United States is not my commander-in-chief. I got the most extraordinary mail saying, if he's not your commander-in-chief, you're not an American. Get out of this country. So the definition of citizenship now is that we obey our commander-in-chief. Now, these acronyms, POTUS, President of the United States, Senate, there's one that sneaked in now, SCOTUS, Supreme Commander of the United States. Can you imagine what the founders would have thought of that? When Adams said the president should be called His Excellency, he was hooted at. He was mocked. We don't have a man on horseback as our president. This is a republic. This isn't a monarchy. And yet we have allowed this kind of talk to come in. We're often told now, you're voting for the commander-in-chief. You're voting for the person who has his hand on the button, who has the football travel with him. And it's all this emanation from the extraordinary power that was given the president to initiate war on his own whim. Originally nuclear war, but then all kinds of war on the model of that.
I recall I was a boy when the Korean War started, and I seem to recall that they were conducting that war as part of the United Nations, that the United Nations was the kind of front for the war, and that has come up again and again, that they were when we're going in war with other nations against the target, then that kind of lets the country off the hook as in terms of declaring an actual war. Let me ask just two other little points. Why hasn't Congress, after all these years, spoken up about this? And number three, what would you do to rectify the situation? Are you writing this book in order to create the controversy?
Let me take the second point first, that why hasn't Congress done anything? Well, when the president starts a war, it's very hard for Congress to say, you had no right to do that, we're going to cut off funds. The charge immediately is you're deserting our boys in the field, at the time then, and now our boys and girls in the field. And Congress has been supine. It has tried occasionally to get its toe in, the War Powers Act, for instance, which didn't work out very well. On your first point, that it was a United Nations action, actually, we sent the initiation of the war occurred on a weekend when the UN was not in session. We sent a message to the UN to hold an emergency session and declare war. We sent our fleet off, the 7th Fleet off, before we got that authorization. And as a matter of fact, the United Nations has no authorization to tell America to go to war because Congress did stand up in this case. When the UN Charter was ratified, there were people, Senators Taft and others, who said, we can't turn over our sovereignty, our war-making power, to an international body. So it was written into the UN Charter that the UN cannot order American forces into action unless Congress authorizes it. But that never happened. So they broke not only the American Constitution, but the UN Charter in going to war in Korea. And they knew that, and they did it deliberately, and it was Dean Acheson's initiative to do that, to protect the power of the president to initiate war on his own hook. So what to do about it? There are a number of things that Congress should do and never does. It's an amazingly spineless body. It's very hard, though, because once the momentum has occurred in which we rally around the president in any kind of emergency, even an emergency that doesn't make much sense, you know, president's popularity goes up in an international emergency, no matter what. The Mayaguez for Ford, a kind of stupid thing, but his popularity went up for a while. The hostage seizure for Carter, his popularity went up during that time. When we're challenged, everybody rallies around the president, and they say, we've got to support the president, we've got to support the nation. And Congress beats a track to be more patriotic than anybody else. What could be done these days? President Obama, I think, was very foolish to say, I'm not really against war, I'm just against the Iraq war, so if it's Afghanistan, I'll be for it. And he kind of backed himself into that during the campaign when he said it was wrong to pull people out of Afghanistan and go to Iraq. And he was right, it was. But that doesn't mean it's right now to go back into Afghanistan in a totally different situation where we're not hunting Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora, but we're trying to put the whole nation back together in an unsustainable way. And the great problem is that he's sinking resources, men, materiel, money, into one country at a time when our military is strained. People are going back for 4 and 5 delegations there, and the National Guard has been totally misused, and our tanks and planes are being ground down. You know, we had to pull troops out to come to Haiti to do some police work. Terrorism is not a country, and you don't wage war on it by waging war on a country. It's metastasized. It's in lots of countries. It's cross borders. We get terrorist attacks launched from London now. Terrorism is a crime, not a country, and the way to fight crime is with intelligence and police reserves from all nations, which we should be coordinating to go after specific terrorist activities, to, first of all, to find them with a lot of good intelligence, using other people's talents and resources. But this idea that you can crush terrorism by taking over one country, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan or wherever, is silly. And I had hoped for better from Obama.
Well, maybe this follows on from that question. The question is this national security secrecy state that we have now reversible? And if you say that it's irreversible, are you committing the great American heresy of pessimism by maintaining that position?
Well, I think Americans are generally more optimistic than pessimistic, and that's why they keep hoping that the president's doing something right and will crush all of our foes. That's an optimistic position. Is it irreversible? It's very hard to reverse. As I say, the War Powers Act tried to reverse it. The Church Committee tried to reverse the CIA crimes and didn't have much success. Maybe the long-term answer is that bomb power can only disappear if you take away the bomb. That sounds too optimistic, not pessimistic. But Paul Nitze, who was a great favorer of the bomb most of his life, ended up saying, it doesn't really help us at all. We should get rid of it. Maybe that's the only way to do it. But I certainly wouldn't underestimate the size of the problem. Consider this. Obama came in saying, we've got to return to the Constitution on things like extraordinary rendition and holding people at Guantanamo without legal representation, and torture, and signing statements in which presidents decide what laws they want to follow. He reversed himself on all those things. You know, immediately Panetta at the CIA said, well, rendition might be something we need down the road, and legal and military tribunals. We'll put some people in the civilian court, but we've got to keep the military tribunals there as an alternative. And Obama started issuing signing statements right away and said, we can't investigate torture. We've got to look forward, not back. Secretary of State Clinton said that the British couldn't release torture information. Why is that? I think you've got to remember this, that we have a vast secret apparatus around the world. Not only our own military and CIA, but a lot of cat's paws and soldiers of fortune that we've lined up over the years. We have more contractors in Afghanistan and Iraq than military people. And most of our interventions around the world, from the Mossadegh in Iran to the Bay of Pigs, we've used all of these cat's paws and local people and not very stable people, many of them. And what does the CIA and other intelligence agencies, many of them, and the NSA, which is now used for spying on Americans in a great way, say to the president when he comes in and he finds out about all these places? They go to him and they say, well, it took us a long time to build up this apparatus, and some of it's not very trustworthy, and if you undercut their morale or undercut their loyalty, they'll start talking about all the dirty tricks they've been up to. And you probably do need them somewhere. You know, you don't realize what we've been doing for you in the secret ways. And so there's a tremendous pressure on a new president to say, my God, what did I step into? Let me give you just one example of the kind of thing we've assembled in a way that's secret to most Americans. The original justification for our coddling dictators and overthrowing people we didn't like around the world was that we had to have friendly bases, originally for the Strategic Air Command, places to land, places to be refueled, places to have lookouts, and then for the submarines, and then for the missiles, and all that kind of thing. And so we wanted to have friendly bases. We wanted the Turks to be on our side so we could put missiles there. But then, as time went on, we found out that if we topple Mossadegh and bring the Shah back, the people in Iran become angry at the Shah and at us, and we've had all the troubles that we had there because we put in the Shah. We thought we were very powerful. That was the first great CIA triumph under Eisenhower. And they thought, my God, now we can do anything around the world. And it got us into more trouble than it solved. So in the 1960s, a very smart guy said, well, let's go to a country where the locals can't overthrow our puppet. Let's go to a place like that. You know, after all, we did that at Hiroshima and the atolls in the Pacific. We just kicked the people out and tested our atom bombs and our hydrogen bombs. So he found an island in the Indian Ocean, Diego Garcia. He was a British protector, and he said, let's make a deal with the British. They'll give us de facto control. We won't tell Congress about it, although our arrangement with the British was technically a treaty that Congress is supposed to ratify. And we'll fund it in a way that the Congress doesn't know anything about. And we'll kick out the natives, thousands of them. And we'll confiscate their property and we'll shoot their livestock. And we'll make this a great staging area for the Middle East, for our nuclear fleets and planes and supplies and that kind of thing. And we'll let no journalists or other people in to tell people what's happening there. And it's been that way ever since. It is that way today. It was an important staging area in the Kuwait War and the Iraq War and now in the Afghanistan War. And most people don't even know it exists. How many of those things around the world is the president all of a sudden told about and said, you can't get rid of these people, you know. You can't write off that. And so, you know, we have a backlog of all these soldiers of fortune. The break-in of the Watergate was done by Cubans who had been used at the Bay of Pigs. You know, these are what they call assets. You know, we've got all these assets, and we've got to put them to some use, so we'll have them break into the Watergate. It's an extremely complicated secret empire that the president steps into and finds his hands tied in some way. You know, it's like the third murderer problem in Macbeth. Once you use murderers, you've got to kill the murderers because they become a problem after that. And so Truman, once Roosevelt had invested all this stuff in the atom bomb, found that he could not use it. He had to use it. He was hostage to his own instrument of power. Well, in some ways, the president is hostage to all these instruments of power that he has out there. He may not want them, but how does he get rid of them? Yes, can you get a mic to?
One of the things I've most appreciated about your work is the vast range, historical range, and I'm curious, many of the things you're talking about, I think, have gone on in some way, rough analogy at least, in history, growth of military power, executive power. Has there ever been an example that you know of the forces on the other side reasserting themselves to get some control over this situation? And does that offer any interesting lessons for us?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if there's been so much an example of control internal to the power, the force that was being exerted. There are thousands of examples, of course, of imperial overreach, of an empire that becomes too unwieldy by extent and by heterogeneity of the components, etc. That's what happened to Rome, that it extended itself so vastly that in order to control itself, it had to bring in barbarian forces, as they called them, and try to recruit them, and they became the constituents of the military emperors. The British, of course, their empire extended far enough that India and other places tried to resist and did. The breakup of the colonial empires after World War II is an extraordinary thing because they had tried to control indigenous forces and they found that the indigenous forces were too much for them. Eisenhower was wise when he said, we can't go into Indochina because France hasn't been able to control this area, even though they converted a lot of people to Catholicism. They had all these things going for them. And if they can't control it, certainly we can't, so we shouldn't get in there at all. Now, some of the more successful empires didn't try to take over territory and didn't try to take over the minerals and the wealth of their subordinates. They used them as bases for trade and other things. For instance, the Venetian Empire. They didn't want to control the islands out in the Adriatic and other parts of the Mediterranean. They just wanted a place where their fleet could touch down while they were trading. And the Genoese did the same thing. And their competition was for ports, not for peoples or materials. And in a way, that was what our empire was. We didn't really want so much to take over these countries. We didn't want to take over an African country when we knocked off Lumumba or tried to. We wanted to have a safe place for our fleets and our airplanes and our operations around the world. So in a way, that's a safer kind of empire than the ones that tried to absorb. You know, Alexander was the first one who tried to absorb the world, and he found out the minute he died, it broke off into these four different fiefdoms of the generals who had fought with him. So is there any way to control it from within? I don't know. It's normally controlled, as I say, from without by inanition, by overreach, by external seeping in of forces to the empire. We've always claimed that we're not an empire, and in some ways we're not. We didn't want so much to take over a place as to use it, to use its geographical and other advantages for our purposes. But in terms of our own integrity, of our own ability to have a people and a Congress that monitors the executive power, I think that's something we'll have to solve in terms of constitutional values, not of imperial overreach. Yeah, there's one there, if you can get a mic to him.
Professor Wills, what strikes me as especially valuable here is the attempt to, first of all, to see the national security state as a problem that needs an explanation and that might suggest some solutions. But I'm wondering if there's not two different kinds of explanation going on here. One is the bomb, and the other seems to be, seems to look at the institutions, the political and social structures which were built up to fight the Second World War and to fight the Cold War over a period of 60 years or 70 years, whatever it is. It seems to me that the reason that you can't change these things is because these structures are still there. And it's whether the bomb's there or not, they'd still be there.
Yeah, the structures are there, but they were caused by the bomb. Remember, people say, well, there was this tremendous mobilization for World War II, and that took off, and normal processes of bureaucratization, et cetera, go on no matter what, whether the bomb had been there or not. Well, England was more mobilized than we were by World War II. They had to be. Of course, they were in the path of the advancing giant. And they didn't have the kind of national security state after the war. In fact, they wanted to demobilize so fast they threw Churchill out. It's what made our situation different is that we did have this great secret that we had to protect and deploy and do it on a scale that was quite different from any other reaction to organization for war and bureaucratization in the wake of war. Those things are all there. Some people want the Weberian explanation that secrecy grows on secrecy and bureaucracy grows on bureaucracy. True enough. But it didn't happen after other wars, and it didn't happen after World War II in other countries. It happened to us because the specific instruments we set up that are still in place, the NSA, the NSC, the CIA, the classification, the clearance, the loyalty tests, all of that huge apparatus, I tick it off month by month in 1946 and 7 and 8, the building up of this huge apparatus, which was unprecedented and unparalleled around the world. So I don't think it's enough to say that World War II mobilized everybody. The reaction to a lot of mobilization is demobilization, that people want to get out of it at the end of the war, and that it couldn't happen in this case because Truman had emergency after emergency after emergency, and he did scare hell out of the country. So I think, did you say two more questions? What? And the last question.
Well, Will our salvation be our impending penury over the next 20 to 30 years?
Well, that's a good question. It will be very difficult to spend us into impotence because our resources are really vast and our ingenuity is pretty vast. We're giving a lot of that away, but we are still the font of expertise. After all, the rest of the world is sending everybody to school in America. There's a reason for that. I teach on a campus, Northwestern, in which the Asian student population is very great. If they could learn all that at home, they wouldn't be coming to us, would they? So I think there's hope for economic resilience in America. Political resilience, maybe not. But another thing, remember, I'm talking about only one aspect of America. And the many other aspects of America are things that I feel we should all be very proud of. For instance, never in history has any nation, including our own, been as alert to human rights as we have been over the last couple of decades. Women's rights, men's rights, minorities' rights, gay rights, Native American rights, handicapped rights. So some people say, oh, we're too interested in rights. Well, isn't that terrible? And that came home to me when I was at the meeting of the American Bar Association in 1992 in San Francisco. And they had a women's caucus lunch. Women's caucus hadn't existed in the Bar Association for very long. And at that lunch, the woman presiding got up on the dais and said, before we begin our formal program, I'd like to ask a few questions. Among you women out there, they're all women lawyers, of course, but only a select group from the whole nation full of women's lawyers. But she said, how many of you were the first to be an editor of your law school journal? A lot rose. How many of you were the first to make senior partner in your law firm? More. How many of you were the first dean of a law school? More. How many of you were the first district woman to be a district judge? More. How many of you were the first woman to be a federal judge? More. How many of you were the first to be a district attorney in your area? Hundreds and hundreds are now standing, and of course they're the first generation or the immediate beneficiaries of the pioneers. This is a vast social revolution. And if you affect women, you're affecting society at its most intimate nexus, because a woman's rights have to do with husband and wife, mother and child, siblings, employer, employees. And it was not only in the law that was the case. It was the case in business, in the academy, in the military, in religious ministry. And what was happening with women was happening with minorities and other people. And I thought, this is the most important social change you can imagine. And we should all be very proud that America has done that. So if we can do that, we can probably do a lot of other things too.
Thank you very much. I hope you'll all join us upstairs for the book signing, which will start in the lobby in just a few minutes.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.